An Essay Upon the Development of Doctrine by John Henry Newman. Chapter 6, Part 9. The Monophysites Continued. It cannot be supposed that such a transaction would approve itself to the churches of Egypt, and the event showed it. They disowned the authority of the council and called its adherents Chalcedonians and Sinaitites. For here was the West tyrannizing over the East, forcing it into agreement with itself, resolved to have one and one only form of words, rejecting the definition of faith which the East had drawn up in council, bidding it and making it frame another, dealing peremptorily and sternly with the assembled bishops, and casting contempt on the most sacred traditions of Egypt. What was Eutyches to them? He might be guilty or innocent. They gave him up. Dioscorus had given him up at Chalcedon. They did not agree with him. He was an extreme man. They would not call themselves by human titles. They were not Eutychians. Eutyches was not their master. But Athanasius and Cyril were their doctors. The two great lights of their church, the two greatest and most successful polemical fathers that Christianity had seen, had both pronounced one nature incarnate, though allowing two before the incarnation. And though Leo and his council had not gone so far as to deny this phrase, they had proceeded to say what was the contrary to it, to explain away, to overlay the truth, by defining that the incarnate Savior was in two natures. At Ephesus it had been declared that the creed should not be touched. Chalcedonian fathers had, not literally but virtually, added to it. By subscribing Leo's tome and promulgating their definition of faith, they had added what might be called the creed of Pope Leo. It is remarkable, as has just been stated, that Dioscorus, wicked man as he was in act, was of the moderate or middle school in doctrine, as the violent and able Severus after him. And from the first, the great body of the protesting party disowned Eutyches, whose form of the heresy took refuge in Armenia, where it remains to this day. The Armenians alone were pure Eutychians, and so zealously such that they innovated on the ancient and recognized custom of mixing water with the wine in the Holy Eucharist, and consecrated the wine by itself in token of the one nature, as they considered, of the Christ. Elsewhere both name and doctrine of Eutyches were abjured. The heretical bodies in Egypt and Syria took a title from their special tenet and formed the Monophysite Communion. Their theology was at once simple and specious. They based it upon the illustration which is familiar to us in the Athanasian Creed, and which had been used by St. Gregory Nazianzen, St. Cyril, St. Augustine, Vincent of Larens, not to say St. Leo himself. They argued that as body and soul made up one man, so God and man made up but one, though one compound nature, in Christ. It might have been charitably hoped that their difference from the Catholics had been a simple matter of words, as it is allowed by Vigilius of Thapsus really to have been in many cases. But their refusal to obey the voice of the Church was a token of real error in their faith, and their implied heterodoxy is proved by their connection in spite of themselves with the extreme or ultra-party whom they so vehemently disowned. It is very observable that, ingenious as is their theory, and sometimes perplexing to a disputant, the Monophysites never could shake themselves free of the Eutychians. And though they could draw intelligible lines on paper between the two doctrines, yet in fact, by a hidden fatality, their partisans were ever running into or forming alliance with the anathematized extreme. Thus, Peter the Fuller, the Theopaschite Eutychian, is at one time in alliance with Peter the Stammerer, who advocated the Henoticon. which was monophysite. The acephaly, though separating from the latter Peter for that advocacy, and accused by Leontius of being Gaianites, Eutychians, are considered by Facundus as monophysites. Timothy the cat, who is said to have agreed with Dioscorus and Peter the Stammerer, who signed the Henoticon, that is, with two monophysite patriarchs, is said nevertheless, according to Anastasius, to have maintained the extreme tenet that the divinity is the sole nature of Christ. Severus, according to Anastasius, symbolized with the Phantasiasts, Eutychians, yet he is a more truly, according to Leontius, the chief doctor and leader of the Monophysites, and at one time there was a union, though temporary, between the Theodosians, Monophysites, and the Gaianites. Such a division of an heretical party into the maintainers of an extreme and a moderate view, perspicuous and plausible on paper, yet in fact unreal, impracticable, and hopeless, was no new phenomenon in the history of the Church. As Eutyches put forward an extravagant tenet, which was first corrected into the Monophysite, and then relapsed hopelessly into the doctrine of the Phantasiasts and the Theopaschites, so had Arius been superseded by the Eusebians, and had revived in Eunomius. And as the moderate Eusebians had formed the great body of the dissentients from the Nicene Council, so did the Monophysites include the mass of those who protested against Chalcedon. And as the Eusebians had been moderate in creed yet unscrupulous in act, so were the Monophysites. And as the Eusebians were ever running individually into pure Arianism, so did the Monophysites run into pure Eutychianism. And as the Monophysites set themselves against Pope Leo, so had the Eusebians, with even less provocation, withstood and complained of Pope Julius. In like manner, the Apollinarians had divided into two sects, one with Timotheus going the whole length of the inferences which the tenet of their master involved, and the more cautious or timid party making an unintelligible stand with Valentinus. Again, in the history of Nestorianism, though it admitted less opportunity for division of opinion, the See of Rome was with St. Cyril in one extreme, Nestorius in the other, and between them the great Eastern party, headed by John of Antioch and Theodoret, not heretical, but for a time dissatisfied with, the Council of Ephesus. The Nestorian heresy, as I have said, gave less opportunity for doctrinal varieties than the heresy of Eutyches. Its spirit was rationalizing, and had the qualities which go with rationalism. When cast out of the Roman Empire, it addressed itself, as we have seen, to a new and rich field of exertion, got possession of an established church, cooperated with the civil government, adopted secular fashions, and, by whatever means, pushed itself out into an empire. Apparently, though it requires a very intimate knowledge of its history to speak except conjecturally, it was a political power rather than a dogma, and despised the science of theology. Eutychianism, on the other hand, was mystical, severe, enthusiastic. With the exception of Severus and one or two more, it was supported by little polemical skill. It had little hold upon the intellectual Greeks of Syria and Asia Minor, but flourished in Egypt, which was far behind the East in civilization, and among the native Syrians. Nestorianism, like Arianism before it, was a cold religion, and more fitted for the schools than for the many. But the Monophysites carried the people with them. Like modern Jansenism, and unlike Nestorianism, the Monophysites were famous for their austerities. They have, or had, 5 Lents in the year, during which laity, as well as clergy, abstain not only from flesh and eggs, but from wine, oil, and fish. Monachism was a characteristic part of their ecclesiastical system. The bishops and Mafrian, or patriarch, were always taken from the monks, who are even said to have worn an iron shirt or breastplate as part of their monastic habit. Severus, patriarch of Antioch at the end of the 5th century, has already been mentioned as an exception to the general character of the Monophysites, and by his learning and ability may be accounted the founder of its theology. Their cause, however, had been undertaken by the emperors themselves before him. For the first 30 years after the Council of Chalcedon, the protesting Church of Egypt had been the scene of continued tumult and bloodshed. Dioscorus had been popular with the people for his munificence, in spite of the extreme laxity of his morals. And for a while the imperial government failed in obtaining the election of a Catholic successor. At length, Proterius, a man of fair character, and the vicar general of Dioscorus on his absence at Chalcedon, was chosen, consecrated, and enthroned. But the people rose against the civil authorities, and the military, coming to their defense, were attacked with stones, and pursued into a church, where they were burned alive by the mob. Next, the popular leaders prepared to intercept the supplies of grain which were destined for Constantinople, and, a defensive retaliation taking place, Alexandria was starved. Then a force of 2,000 men was sent for the restoration of order, who permitted themselves scandalous excesses toward the women of Alexandria. Proterius's life was attempted, and he was obliged to be attended by a guard. The bishops of Egypt would not submit to him. Two of his own clergy, who afterwards succeeded him, Timothy and Peter, seceded, and were joined by 4 or 5 of the bishops and by the mass of the population. And the Catholic patriarch was left without a communion in Alexandria. He held a council and condemned the schismatics, and the emperor, seconding his efforts, sent them out of the country and enforced the laws against the Eutychians. An external quiet succeeded. Then Marcion died, and then forthwith Timothy the Cat made his appearance again, first in Egypt, then in Alexandria. The people rose in his favor, and carried in triumph their persecuted champion to the great Caesarean church, where he was consecrated patriarch by 2 deprived bishops who had been put out of their sees, whether by a council of Egypt or of Palestine. Timothy, now raised to the episcopal rank, began to create a new succession. He ordained bishops for the churches of Egypt and drove into exile those who were in possession. The imperial troops who had been stationed in Upper Egypt returned to Alexandria. The mob rose again, broke into the church where St. Proterius was in prayer, and murdered him. A general ejectment of the Catholic clergy throughout Egypt followed. On their betaking themselves to Constantinople, to the new emperor, Timothy and his party addressed him also. They quoted the fathers and demanded an abrogation of the Council of Chalcedon. Next they demanded a conference. The Catholics said that what was once done could not be undone. Their opponents agreed to this and urged it as their very argument against Chalcedon, that it added to the faith and reversed former decisions. After a rule of 3 years, Timothy was driven out and Catholicism restored. But then, in turn, the Monophysites rallied, and this state of warfare and alternate success continued for 30 years. At length the imperial government, wearied out with a dispute which was interminable, came to the conclusion that the only way of restoring peace to the church was to abandon the Council of Chalcedon. In the year 482 was published the famous Henoticon, or Pacification, of Zeno, in which the emperor took it upon himself to determine a matter of faith. the Henoticon, declared that no symbol of faith but that of the Nicene Creed, commonly so called, should be received in the churches. It anathematized the opposite heresies of Nestorius and Eutyches, and it was silent on the question of the one or two natures after the incarnation. This middle measure had the various effects which might be anticipated. It unified the great body of the Eastern bishops, who readily relaxed into the vague profession of doctrine from which they had been roused by the authority of St. Leo. All the Eastern bishops signed this imperial formulary. But this unanimity of the East was purchased by a breach with the West, for the popes cut off the communication between Greeks and Latins for 35 years. On the other hand, the more zealous Monophysites, disgusted at their leaders for accepting what they considered an unjustifiable compromise, split off from the Eastern churches and formed a sect by themselves, which remained without bishops, acephali, for 300 years, when at length they were received back into the communion of the Catholic Church. Dreary and waste was the condition of the Church, and forlorn her prospects, at the period which we have been reviewing. After the brief triumph which attended the conversion of Constantine, trouble and trial had returned upon her. Her imperial protectors were failing in power or faith. Strange forms of evil were rising in the distance, and were thronging for the conflict. There was but one spot in the whole of Christendom, one voice in the whole episcopate, to which the faithful turned in hope in that miserable day. In the year 493, in the pontificate of Gelasius, the whole of the East was in the hands of traitors to Chalcedon, and the whole of the West under the tyranny of the open enemies of Nicaea. Italy was the prey of robbers. Mercenary bands had overrun its territory, and barbarians were seizing on its farms and settling in its villas. The peasants were thinned by famine and pestilence. Tuscany might even be said, as Gelasius words it, to contain scarcely a single inhabitant. Odoacer was sinking before Theodoric, and the Pope was changing one Arian master for another. And as if one heresy were not enough, Pelagianism was spreading with the connivance of the bishops in the territory of Picenum. In the north of the dismembered empire, the Britons had first been infected by Pelagianism, and now were dispossessed by the heathen Saxons. The Armoricans still preserved a witness of Catholicism in the west of Gaul, but Picardy, Champagne, and the neighboring provinces, where some remnant of its supremacy had been found, had lately submitted to the yet heathen Clovis. The Arian kingdoms of Burgundy in France, and of the Visigoths in Aquitaine and Spain, oppressed a zealous and Catholic clergy. Africa was in still more deplorable condition under the cruel sway of the Vandal Gundamond. The people, indeed, uncorrupted by the heresy, but their clergy in exile, and their worship suspended. While such was the state of the Latins, what had happened in the East? Acacius, the patriarch of Constantinople, had secretly taken part against the Council of Chalcedon, and was under papal excommunication. Nearly the whole East had sided with Acacius, and a schism had begun between East and West, which lasted, as I have above stated, for 35 years. The Henoticon was in force, and at the imperial command had been signed by all the patriarchs and bishops throughout the Eastern Empire. In Armenia the churches were ripening for the pure Eutychianism which they adopted in the following century. And in Egypt the acephali, already separated from the Monophysite patriarch, were extending in the east and west of the country, and preferred the loss of the episcopal succession to the reception of the Council of Chalcedon. And while Monophysites or their favorers occupied the churches of the Eastern Empire, Nestorianism was making progress in the territories beyond it. Barsumas had held the See of Nisibis, Theodore was read in the schools of Persia, and the successive Catholici of Seleucia had abolished monachism and were secularizing the clergy. If, then, there is now a form of Christianity such that it extends throughout the world, though with varying measures of prominence or prosperity in separate places, that it lies under the power of sovereigns and magistrates in various ways alien to its faith, that flourishing nations and great empires, professing or tolerating the Christian name, lie over against it as antagonists, that schools of philosophy and learning are supporting theories and following out conclusions hostile to it, and establishing an exegetical system subversive of its scriptures, that it has lost whole churches by schism, and is now opposed by powerful communions once part of itself, that it has been altogether, or almost, driven from some countries, that in others its line of teachers is overlaid, its flocks oppressed, its churches occupied, its property held by what may be called a duplicate succession, that in others its members are degenerate and corrupt, and are surpassed in conscientiousness and in virtue, as in gifts of intellect, by the very heretics whom it condemns, that heresies are rife, and bishops negligent within its own pale, and that, amid its disorders and fears, there is but one voice for whose decisions the peoples wait with trust, one name and one see, to which they look with hope, and that name Peter, and that see Rome. Such a religion is not unlike the Christianity of the 5th and 6th centuries. End of chapter 6.